question for Pat. All of the examples you gave seem to be objections to scientific advances from either popes or theologians. Were there any from non-religious, secular philosophers?
Well, of course, what you must remember is that there wasn't a significant secular population, shall we say, until really quite recently. I think by and large, when you look at the history of science, the objections do tend to come out of people with religious views. On the other hand, it should be also said that there are people with religious views who are very supportive of science. So you'll see both things. But what I think you tend not to see very much of are people who are, like, let's say, David Hume in the 18th century, who was clearly an atheist, but he was not opposed to, for example, work by Thomas Willis on blood transfusions or dissection or anything of that kind.
Any other questions? Yeah. Oh, there's one. Larry. Thank you.
Oh, well, yes, that's a very good question. So what happened in 1870? Well, it was, I'm not going to be able to give you a really suitable detailed answer, but it was basically a political struggle within the church between various monasteries and their favorite bishops and cardinals and other monasteries and their favorites. So the Jesuits were on one side and so forth, and I think the Benedictines and others were on the other side. One of the crucial issues, you'll find this very funny, I'm sure, but one of the crucial issues had to do with whether or not the Pope was infallible when he spoke ex cathedra. And so the Pope was not, in fact, infallible until 1870 either. And part of the issue was that the Pope himself wanted to be infallible when he spoke ex cathedra. But people realized, I guess this was actually the Jesuits, realized this was not a great idea because the popes had in fact had quite different views on various things in the past. And they also realized that this would really sort of encase in concrete any decision that some particular pope happened to make and speak ex cathedra. So, but then the Pope said, yes, but look, when I speak ex cathedra, it's really God speaking through me, so how could I not be correct? So these debates were very important to people at the time, and they seem odd to us now because it's really just not a framework that we have anymore.
Yeah. Can I ask a question? We'll be about 15 minutes late, but that's fine. We'll eat that up in the meeting wrap-up, Duane. So there was a poll. This is about public communication of science, and you guys are in the forefront of all of this. There was a poll recently done by the Pew Foundation, and they did a survey. They always survey general audiences to find out what they think about science and science literacy. This time they also surveyed 1,000 people recommended by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, scientists. And the answers came back fairly predictably, I suppose, that the public thought science was wonderful and thought that the sun went around the earth and got all sorts of things wrong, but they thought the science was wonderful. The scientists, on the other hand, thought that the public was fairly stupid and in need of instant repair. But Alan Leshner, the CEO of the AAAS, said this was an appalling result and that not enough scientists were coming forward and actually communicating and being willing to communicate what they were doing. And he thought that was really bad since they were being paid in large by the public. So one of the issues here is how to communicate these sorts of things. And one of the questions I've been asking some of these folks is, isn't there a disconnect between a public which, because of the way the media communicates things, and also the way you have to write your grants, the public perceives you as delivering certitude. Here's a cure. Here's a war on cancer. We're going to fix it. But in fact, you all know, how many scientists in the room anyway? How many of you are scientists? You know that science doesn't work like that. It's a moving target. It doesn't deliver certitude. It tends towards things. So there's this problem of then opening up the New York Times the following day and reading a thing that said, the story that was in there about the depression gene recently, sorry, wasn't quite right, and have to retract that and so on. So how do you balance this, getting the enthusiasm of people behind an organization and a research effort like this, which is plainly doing amazing things, but not over-promising, and keeping people in with you, but also not disappointing them at the same time? How do you do that?
Well, I'd like to answer that, because I had a kind of tiring clinic yesterday because of that very question. You have people whose hopes have been raised by people like me, you know, who are stem cell biologists. I'm also a physician, and that's where I get this shuddering reality check, because we're not getting there quickly enough and effectively enough for these people who really think that the science is doing a better job at getting rid of these scourges to humanity. So I think that what we need to do is work as a group to make sure that we really don't get too religious about our science, that, you know, we don't start to promulgate our ideas as if they're entirely factual. We have to understand, actually, that we understand the truth in the context of our experiments. You know, that we all have problems with the experimental design inducing certain artifacts, and that we have to be able to make sure that our work is peer-reviewed and that it can be reproduced in different systems, and that at the end of the day, when we come to a patient, we've looked at the problem from many different angles, and that's all we can say. We've looked at this problem from a number of different angles. We've had a lot of people who are very smart working on it together, and we've been able to do this as a team. And usually that involves funding organizations that are prescient in terms of understanding that the scientific reality is that you have to understand what Francis Bacon was saying, that you have to be able to observe first before generating hypotheses, and then test your hypotheses to see if they're correct. And I think CIRM has done that. I think we have some very enlightened donors, like Mr. Sanford, that understand that. And I think we have a true opportunity here to move forward, to really change how we practice medicine. So although there's a healthcare crisis in this country, the idea that our healthcare costs will spiral out of control is predicated on the idea that there won't be any advances in medicine. We can make tremendous advances in medicine, diagnostically, therapeutically, but we have to caution ourselves to make sure that the process is regulated and that we are very, very stringent about the science. So that's my goal.
Okay. Francis Bacon, just to put a little footnote on that, the stuff that I put on the Science Network, I call it a general rubric of the facts of the matter. And the term matter of fact or fact of the matter wasn't even used in science, didn't even exist until Gilbert and Harvey and Hooke and Boyle started doing experimental work in 1600. Bacon's novel, The New Atlantis, was really where he talked about the merchants of light on this island of Bensalem, Solomon's house. That became the Royal Society, which has its 350th anniversary next year, 2010. So there is this 350-year enterprise, this business of science, which has been providing solutions for this period, and the facts of the matter are now a part of that enterprise. I just want to say one last thing, which will be helpful for you, for some of you who will doubtless be moved to go and rush out of here and communicate science immediately. There's a new book out by Cornelia Dean, who used to edit the Science Times, and she quotes somebody in here, a science communication specialist, is saying that it's no surprise that researchers view journalists as, one, insufficiently concerned with accuracy, superficial, sensationalist, focused on controversy and tension, ignorant, unethical, and willing to do anything to get the story. It's equally unshocking to find that journalists view researchers as boring, hair-splitting, caveating things to death, overly interested in process, unable to articulate a bottom line or distinguish the forest for the trees, and users of an unintelligible jargon. Are these the worst problems? No, the problem of objectivity is worse. So I do recommend this book. It's called Am I Making Myself Clear? A Scientist's Guide to Talking to the Public. I've actually found these talks very clear, and we're up for some more. Do you have any questions of this panel, by the way? Yes.
I have a couple of quick questions. One is, how does anyone know the rate of rise of money that's being spent on stem cell research in this country? Just, and I ask that so I have an idea of how fast is this really growing. And the other question I have is, it seems one of the things that would be an impediment to real science progress would be, how do you stem the charlatans from going forward and injecting tendons with peripheral blood, suspecting that it'll fix a torn tendon?
I think for the rate of rise of funding, you know, in this state, we have a great rate of rise of funding, which is great. I was at a regenerative medicine workshop with NIH directors a couple of weeks ago, and I think they've got $10 billion infused for stem cell research. They're not sure how to spend it, and they do want to curb the rate of rise of charlatans that can go up at the same rate, but are a bit fearful about how to introduce this. So I think that the best way is to get scientists and physicians and patient advocates who know what they're dealing with, they know what the target is, they basically know the bottom line, and then again, industry collaborators who know whether there's going to be an economic impact and whether this is doable, and then also the insurance companies. The economic reality is these are going to be expensive therapies unless we get very, very clever. So they have to be something that can actually be made into a product. So I think that the rate of rise isn't commensurate with what we're capable of, but hopefully that will change. And how do you curb charlatans? Hopefully we all try to curb our enthusiasm a little bit and look at what the results are telling us. But I think we have philosophers, we have institutional review boards that help with that.
But you raise a good point. There's in cell stem cell, there's a piece by Tim Caulfield there, in fact, about the burgeoning rise of people going, just Googling stem cell clinic, which is not a great idea.
I think, you know, one of the things that would help is that if the regulatory authorities can, with the help of experts from academia, from industry, et cetera, begin to articulate what the responsible regulatory path will be for developing these, then you can say that's the standard to which you'd like to see any work done. And if others are going to deviate from that standard, then it's clear that they are. But right now, because there's really lack of clarity, it's just sort of a blank sheet of paper, and people sort of make up the rules as they go along, unfortunately. I don't know, if, Evan, you're on the advisory board for the FDA for these for stem cell-based cell therapies. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, the FDA has gotten a few more stem cell biologists on their advisory group. And these, and we approach applications from industry the way we would peer review a grant or a manuscript. In fact, we just went over an application, and, you know, I can talk about it because it's a public record, where it actually was not for anything all that critically important in terms of health benefit. It was actually for a cosmetic use of autologous cells taken from the back of the ear of patients that this company would expand and send back to dermatologists to fix nasolabial folds that are now becoming more prominent with age. At first, it seemed like a very, you know, kind of a silly waste of our time. You know, this group of scientists that should be pondering this application, until we realized that it would only be the second application of an autologous cell transplant ever approved by the FDA. And once it's out there, physicians can use anything they want off-label. So then we took it fairly seriously. The efficacy was actually proven as a result of their clinical trials, but they had leapfrogged over any kind of attempt to characterize the cells, how they were changing, what happened to them after they were transplanted, things of that sort. So they were dinged on safety, and the safety was based on not having characterized the cells the way anybody in this room would have spent a little bit of effort characterizing their cells and their fate. So I think what the FDA is doing essentially is holding everybody to the same criteria that scientists would. And I think that ultimately will not only make gain some credibility for the process, but ensure that there really is some safety and good therapies going forward. And also, most importantly, squash the charlatans. I think one needs to advertise what the level, what the bar is for treatment, and educate the public and say that, you know, the FDA is not the barrier. The way the charlatans operate is that they picture themselves as the FDA, the medical establishment, the scientific establishment is the barrier of patients to life-giving therapies. And through education and through this, we can combat that, and that's what will shut down the charlatans.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make one point. Hematopoietic cell transplantation has been going on in this country for many years. That has been a tightly regulated process and something that can be used as a template, basically, to develop these regulatory things.
So one last comment, because I'd like to hear from Wendy as well. I mean, you must go through, well, if Pfizer hasn't done it yet, I'm going to go and do it myself. And you're saying, well, I kind of have to go through a process here.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think you do. I mean, I, like everybody here, came out of academics, and I still really live between the two worlds. And I was terrified when I took this hedgehog protocol to the FDA. And actually, as it turns out, we're taking it to the EU. One of our sites is in Italy. And I was terrified because I thought, it's going to go really good or really bad, and there's going to be nothing in between. And I'm a bench-based physician. This was actually my first foray into writing a protocol as well. So, you know, I had a very new team. Pfizer had not done hematology trials. You know, we had, you know, everything was new, just based, again, on some work with Katrina over the last year. And it was very interesting. The FDA didn't question it. They had all kinds of other questions, but they never, and I was very direct about, I'm going after a cancer stem cell. I don't know how different that cancer stem cell is than, you know, one step prior to that, not been characterized, you know, per se. It was fascinating. They didn't question it at all, and the same thing with Italy. It was very interesting, and I don't know why. But, yeah.
Good job there are no cameras in here.
Yeah.
I mean, we can wrap up at this point. Pat, did you have one final thought on this or not? Or before we burn you at the stake?
No, not really. I mean, of course, any idiot can put a word in front of therapy, open a blog and sell it, you know, and there's all kinds of, you know, the gooch therapy and the this and the that therapy, and those are the ones that really scare me, because the sort of science skeptics amongst the folks, as it were, often gravitate towards those because they do promise everything, and they're really heartbreaking because people spend money on it.
Yeah. That's not specific to stem cell therapy. Those of us that have been in oncology have, you know, our patients come in every week with, you know, Laetril and all, you name it. It's, you know, so it's not, I guess I would preface that it's not specific.